88.1 KFCF Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 1 p.m. Up now, Women's Magazine.
Feminist women.
Mulheres feministas.
Zanone feminist.
Banyu Vachikonzero Chevakadze.
Nessa.
Mujeres feministas.
Young femini. Femme activist.
Nari Mukti.
Matatan na babae.
Kechimai. Ka ishk.
This week on Women's Magazine.
There's a high percentage, more than a quarter of these people die after usually a woman calls 911 for help with an emotionally disturbed child or because of domestic abuse. As mothers and people trying to deal with violence in our households, we are on our own pretty much.
We'll talk with Arlene Eisen about a new report on the killing of 313 black people by police or security guards in 2012. And we'll deconstruct the war on obesity with authors and activists Jen Larson and Virgie Tovar.
I live a fabulous life, and I know that that's something I've been told that I'm not allowed to have because I'm a 250-pound woman, and yet, you know, here I am doing it. And because I study gender and sexuality, I know a lot about myths that parade around as truth.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Women's Magazine. I'm Kate Raphael. I hope you've gotten your taxes in, which I haven't. Coming up in the second half of our show today, I'll talk with two tremendously smart, honest, and funny women about the war on obesity and what it has to do with the war on women. Jen Larson and Virgie Tovar will join me. But first, Operation Ghetto Storm. At least 313 black people were killed by police, security guards, or vigilantes in 2012. That's one every 28 hours. I'll be back with that story in just a minute.
You believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes. You believe in freedom, cannot rest. Hear me talking to you. We believe in freedom.
We believe
and
in
freedom.
Nearly every day in this country, at least every 28 hours, a black person is killed by police, security guards, or vigilante claiming state-sanctioned authority. The vast majority of these extrajudicial killings, 93%, are men. The Malcolm X grassroots movement has documented 313 such killings in 2012 in a new report entitled Operation Ghetto Storm. Arlene Eisen is the principal author of that report. She joins me now in studio. Arlene is a freelance journalist, longtime anti-racist and anti-imperialist activist, and the author of the book Women of Vietnam. She's a member of the Malcolm X Solidarity Committee and the mother of two young black men. We were also hoping to be joined by Rosa Clemente, a member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, hip-hop artist and journalist, and a contributor to this report as well, but unfortunately she was not available at the last minute. Arlene, talk about how you compiled this report.
Well, it's basically the product of about a year's research. Trayvon Martin was murdered the end of February last year, and I was in a conversation with a comrade at Malcolm X, grassroots movement, Kali Yakuno, talking about the problem of people seeing Trayvon's murder as an isolated case. And we were talking about how there was a lack of data on other cases, similar cases, and how they showed that this sort of extrajudicial killing was systematic. And so that began the research. Actually, I did a very, very quick 3 days of very intensive research and put out a report, the first quarterly report. And then in July, we put out a six-month report, which showed that there had been 120 cases. And I was convinced, based on that research, that there were way more cases out there, but there is no national database. The feds do not require police departments to report these killings. So basically, it's a very painstaking kind of click and click and click kind of internet research. And at this point, I've verified 313 cases. I think there are probably at least 80 or 90 more out there that I couldn't track down whether what their race was or whether they actually died or what their name was. There'd be a brief note in a newspaper saying the police killed a man on such and such an avenue in such a city. Philadelphia, Chicago are notoriously bad on reporting these cases, I think deliberately so.
So how did you find all these newspapers? Did you go to the library and look through microfilm, or were you looking all online? Or
pretty much online. If you Google officer involved shooting in such and such a city, you'll get a bunch of cases, and they'll lead it to more cases and more cases. Wikipedia has a list, which is very, very incomplete, that doesn't provide the race at all and generally only gives the initial press release that the police put out.
Well, you know, we're not supposed to talk about race. We're post-racial, right?
Yeah, right. But our point is that the number of black people killed is way, way out of proportion to their percentage in the population, and that's not an accident, that it's quite systematic and that these killings are part of a war that's been waged on black people forever, but in modern times, at least since the 1960s, to suppress the urban uprisings in Watts and Harlem and Chicago and Detroit and so on.
And that leads to the title of the report, Operation Ghetto Storm. What does that mean? How did you choose that title?
I first read it in a report that this guy named Balco did called Overkill, which is a libertarian view of the militarization of police. And he found it on a T-shirt in a police training camp where the police were being trained in military tactics. And one of the trainers had it on his T-shirt, Operation Ghetto Storm, with a picture of a cityscape in flames. And it basically is a takeoff on Operation Desert Storm, which was the code name for the first invasion and occupation of Iraq. The reason why we thought it was appropriate as a title for this report was because it really is a war. I mean, police are no longer, if they ever were, in black communities to protect and serve or even to enforce laws. They're there on a war footing. There is this us and them mentality, kill or be killed. And they're there to control and suppress the population. And even if you look at the most recent revelations that came out in the stop and frisk trial in New York City, I don't know if your listeners have followed that, but the Center for Constitutional Rights has brought this suit against the city of New York and the police department. And they have played tapes showing that the police consciously say, the purpose of stop and frisk is to make sure every black person understands that the police own the streets, that they don't own the streets.
And you also talked with some of the families of people who had been killed, right?
But that isn't really the basis of the research. I mean, with 313 cases, most of the information that I have about families comes from the news stories. And also, since the corporate media mainly relies on police press releases. What I had to do is once I got a name and a date for somebody who was killed, you know, I kind of scoured the web looking for Facebook entries, looking for comments, community newspapers, leaflets, whatever I could find that gave the family and the community point of view. And invariably, what the families say is, why?
Well, what about why? I mean, if you read the police accounts, in almost every case, the person was either waving a weapon or in the process of committing a felony. And if you read the family's accounts and the accounts of friends and people who witnessed the event, it seems like inevitably or in almost every situation, the person was doing nothing threatening and had never been involved in any illegal activity. I mean, how many of the cases that you documented involved people who were unarmed? Let's start with that. Or what proportion about?
Well, it's not such a simple answer, because what happens is, for example, like in the case that happened here in Vallejo last spring, a man whose last name was Barrett, who supposedly had a gun and actually had a metallic object that held his business cards. And lots of times the police claim there's a gun when there isn't, or they, to give them the benefit of the doubt, a mistake of cell phone or a cigarette case or something of that sort for a gun. And you have to also remember that in many of the states, in most of the states where these killings happen, possession of a gun is not illegal. And in many of these states, you don't even have to register a gun. You can conceal a weapon. I mean, it's not illegal. And In the corporate press, generally, possession of a weapon on the part of someone who's already died, particularly if they're black, is justification enough for killing them. Whereas in these very same jurisdictions, you have all this brouhaha about the right to bear arms. So there's an interesting contradiction there.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So of the 113, 136, or 44%, had absolutely no weapon at all at the time they were executed. Then another 83, or 27%, allegedly possessed a gun. But like I said, it's been demonstrated over and over that the police lie about gun possession. By the way, this is not in the report, but I just read on Huffington Post the other day, again from Balco, who's a great source of information about the police. He interviewed a police expert whose job it was to train police on policies about when deadly force was appropriate. And he said, even though he's been studying this stuff for 10 years, he was shocked by the guy's response. He says, we don't talk about that. The only thing we talk about is how to justify it to the press after they've killed somebody. What initially triggered these deadly encounters? How did they start? 43% began with some sort of racial profiling. And this is where the issue of comparing it with white shooting is just impossible. That 43% of these deadly encounters began because the so-called suspect appeared, behaved, or drove suspiciously. 19% of these encounters began with calls to 911 for help with emotionally disturbed household members, usually children, sometimes parents, sometimes spouses, but people with diagnosed mental health issues, 19%.
Well, that leads me to a question that I wanted to ask, which has to do with the role of black women in these situations, or the situation that black women are put in many cases. Because in many situations, I think the people that are calling the police in those situations are women, are mothers or lovers, you know, who are afraid for their lives a lot of times.
Right.
So your report has a brief section on how black women are affected. I mean, as I said, 93% of the people who the killings that you documented were of men. Some of the women were killed actually in car chases, I think, and some of them were accidental victims or, unintended victims. But the report does talk some about the broader context in which women are involved in these killings. Can you talk about that a little?
I'm sorry Rosa isn't here, because when we were first talking about doing this report, it was Rosa who said to me, you have to show how this stuff affects women. Our society, particularly since 9/11, has been totally militarized, not just because of the foreign wars, but because of the militarization of the police at home. And this involves several million people under arms. And there's an enormous effect of this militarization on the culture itself, so that in terms of breeding a kind of macho, violent, predatory culture that I think has an enormous effect on encouraging rape and all kinds of other gender-based violence. The places where you really see a systematic, the institutionalization of patriarchy play out in these killings is that there's a high percentage, more than a quarter of these 313 people die after usually a woman calls 911 for help with an emotionally disturbed child or because of domestic abuse. When I saw that data, what came to mind was how we are pretty, as mothers and people trying to deal with violence in our households, we are on our own pretty much. What has happened in this country is that whatever support used to exist, for example, in Oakland, they used to be called something called the Black Women's Anti-Violence Project in the 1980s, that had a hotline and people could call them for intervention with abusive partners or abusive men, period, for counseling, for resources, for intervention. And there are still some a smattering of projects like that around the country. But more often than not, the anti-domestic violence movement has been totally absorbed as pretty much an arm of the state. They're kind of intermediaries and between the women who are targets of the abuse and the police. And that pretty much just contributes to the problem, not just because the police end up killing the men involved without trial, etc., but also it further disempowers women. And ditto for support with emotionally disturbed family members. So more often than not, a mother will call 911, not even for the police, because remember, when you call 911, you call the same number for the police and the ambulance. And she'll say, I need help getting my child, and not always a male child. Charmel Edwards, for example, this woman with a diagnosed mental illness, was smothered to death by police after her grandmother, actually, I believe, called for an ambulance. The police came, they couldn't control her, and they ended up smothering her. And that issue of control is really the key issue of why people get killed.
Because you could say, you know, well, if a woman calls the police, she might live to regret it, but if she doesn't, she might not live at all. And the report asserts that there should be grassroots community-based alternatives for people facing dangerous situations. But as you've said, these alternatives in most places that people would find themselves don't exist. And I know that even here, even though there are two groups that I want to mention in the Bay Area that definitely have an anti-retributive justice approach to violence against women, and that's San Francisco Women Against Rape and Mujeres Unidas, both have projects that are about trying to find non-state alternatives for women in violent situations, but still it's about looking for those alternatives and not really like those alternatives exist. So if a woman is in a situation where she feels like her life is in danger or might be in danger, either from an intimate partner or a child or a neighbor, you know, what would you advocate that she do in that very situation?
I personally don't feel like I have the right to tell a woman what she should do in any given situation. I mean, if she were my friend and I had a chance to talk to her and hear all the details and brainstorm with her about alternatives and so on, maybe I would give her some advice. But in the abstract, I think it's an impossible question. And all I can say is that to encourage a kind of model like this, there's an organization called Philly Stands Up. There's another one in Seattle called Community Against Rape and Abuse, abbreviated CARA. The Audre Lorde Project called Safe Outside the System, which is particularly for LGBT people. And also there's something called the Gulabi Gang. I don't know if people have seen images of these women. They wear pink saris in northern India, and they carry these long bamboo poles. Very often their presence outside a house where a woman is screaming or a hut where women are screaming is enough to cool the man down.
Periodically, when somebody's killed, like Oscar Grant or Alan Bluford here in Oakland or Kimani Gray recently in New York or Trayvon Martin, especially when it's a young unarmed teen, there's a brief explosion of protest, which will lead to a small amount of press attention to the issue. But then it dies down and it doesn't seem to lead to any systemic change or build a broader social movement. Which I think is different than in the 60s and 70s, often riots that began, that were triggered by one of these police killings, ended up, you know, resulting in anti-poverty programs and money being allocated actually for institutions that might result in more community empowerment or more community control of the police. Do you think it's possible at this point to move beyond these kind of short-lived, essentially symbolic conflagrations to something with broader significance for social change?
We're in very different historic times than the 60s. And unfortunately, I think the state learned the lessons of the 60s better than we did in a way. And I think the Obama presidency has done a lot to misdirect political energy towards looking to the government for solutions and for defining the issues in ways that are not helpful for solving them. For example, you know, the whole myth of the post-racial society makes it very difficult to see the problem of the systematic killing, and not just killing, the mass incarceration, the total surveillance. At the same time, and I can't really speak for MSGM, but they have put out a handbook of self-defense organizing called Let Our Motto Be Resistance, and it's available on their website, as is this report, MSGM.org.
MXGM.org.
Yes, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. Basically, I think one of the main points in that handbook is to spread the word, because there has been so much of a cloud, so much confusion, so much reliance on the Democratic Party to solve problems faced by the black community, that's really the first step, is a kind of mass education campaign.
Operation Ghetto Storm is a new report issued by the Malcolm X grassroots movement documenting 313 extrajudicial killings of black people by police, security guards, or vigilantes in 2012. And we will, of course, link that report to our website, which is kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com. Arlene Eisen is the principal author of that report. Arlene, thanks so much for your time.
Hear me talking to you. We will believe in freedom.
We will believe
and not
in
rest until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons is as important as the killing of white men. White mothers, sons, do you believe in
with me if you like it?
We who believe in freedom
and not freedom telling our
man. The older I get, the better I know that the secret of my going on is when the reins are in the hands of the young who dare to run against the storm. Cause to me, young people come first.
You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael. Coming up, we look at another form of discrimination that can at times be equally dangerous. How is the war on obesity really a war on women's bodies? I'll speak with Virgie Tovar and Jen Larson when we come back.
Joy, you have such a pretty face. If you just lost 30 pounds, you'd be gorgeous.
I'm already gorgeous.
You've got such a pretty face.
It's a shame about your weight.
You know, you've got such great style. It's a shame about your personality.
You don't turn on the radio or television or pick up a newspaper any day without hearing something about obesity. Dr. Oz called it the number one threat to national security. On a program with Michelle Obama, who's made it her platform issue, as it would be called if she were a beauty contestant, Southwest Airlines and AirTran and maybe some other airlines require passengers of a certain size, and they don't say what size, to buy two tickets for one ride. And the food giant Whole Foods requires employees to meet a certain body mass index to qualify for a discount on their food. We're told that fat people are to blame for the rise in healthcare costs rather than the fat paychecks of the healthcare and insurance executives. One subject that's rarely broached is the impact of this national obsession with our weight on the people who are deemed fat or obese. Is it necessarily true that thin people are healthier or happier than fat people? My guests today are looking at that question in two unique books recently released by Seal Press, based here in Berkeley. Virgie Tovar is the editor of Hot and Heavy, Fierce Fat Girls on Life, Love, and Fashion. She's a fat activist, sexologist, and coach. She has a master's in human sexuality with a focus on women and body image and is the former host of The Virgie Show on KCBS Radio. She's been featured on women's entertainment television and travels worldwide speaking and performing. Jen Larson is author of Stranger Here, How Weight Loss Surgery Transformed My Body and Messed With My Head. Jen has a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from the University of San Francisco. She's a blogger, writer, and editor living in Salt Lake City. People magazine gave her book 4 stars, saying, "Honest, brave, and sparklingly funny, Larson's memoir reminds us that one size doesn't and shouldn't fit all." Both of these very talented women are joining me now by phone. Thanks so much for being with us.
Of course.
Thank you for having us.
So, Virgie, I'm going to start with you. What's it like in this weight-obsessed society to be selling a book on why it's fabulous to be fat?
It feels amazing. It feels subversive. When I was in graduate school, I started studying fat women and how fatness affected their gender identity and sexuality. And through that experience, I essentially went down kind of the rabbit hole of fat activism. And I met so many amazing activists and so many fearless, fabulous fat women. And they changed the way that I saw the world. I was invited to attend a fat conference, which was in Oakland that year in 2010. And when I arrived, the first thing that I saw when I got into the hotel was the pool, and all around it, there were these beautiful big women in bikinis and polka dot bathing suits, and they had huge sunglasses on, they had huge attitudes, and they weren't friendly, and they were so hot, and I was so incredibly moved by them. And I remember in my mind, there's the image. They had all these cute sort of boys around them carrying parasols so that they wouldn't get sunburned. And I was completely dazzled and seduced by this image. And I feel like this is kind of the image that I want to send to or give out to the world through Hot and Heavy. And I think I live a fabulous life. And I know that that's something I've been told that I'm not allowed to have because I'm a 250-pound woman. And yet, you know, here I am doing it. And because I study gender and sexuality, I know a lot about myths that parade around as truths, essentially. And the truth is that we're all entitled to a life that has joy and great love and pleasure and freedom, regardless of our size. And sometimes all someone needs is one example that it's possible for them to have that. And with Hot and Heavy, I wanted to give people 31 models of that possibility.
And, I mean, there's been quite a lot of books written about size acceptance and about how women's self-esteem is shaped by the pressure to have a certain body type. Yours is an anthology, as you say, 31 different perspectives. What did you aim to do that would be different and would be really adding to the conversation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the book was obviously written on the backs of a lot of these books, and I don't think it would have been possible without them. But I see Hot and Heavy as uniquely unapologetic on lots of levels. I mean, to start with, there's a plus-size Latina porn star on the cover of Hot and Heavy, and, you know, how many books can say that about themselves? And I think that the book comes off as unapologetic because the women in the book, myself included, actually find so much joy and subversion and hotness in our fatness. So you clearly get the sense, from me at least, and I think a lot of others, that fatness is a source of pride and sexiness, and that, you know, my fat life, for example, is a special secret that many people don't understand. And the women in the book are talking about so many facets of their lives, and the fact that they talk about having sex has been something that's been kind of controversial. There's actually a chapter in the book entitled Journeying into a Fat, Fleshy Vulva, and this is perhaps the first story of its kind that's been published. I don't really know. That's what I think. But in Hot and Heavy, women write about dating and motherhood, sex work, what it's like to go to the gym as a fat person or be a fat yoga instructor. You know, they write about cancer, about survival and fashion, and you get the sense that we're writing for each other, not to explain away our existence or to apologize for it, but to laugh about it and cry about it and flaunt it and celebrate it. And I think that those are the things that make Hot and Heavy really unique.
Well, Jen, you chose a very different path in your terms of your life than the women in Virgie's anthology. Can you talk some about that journey which you describe in Stranger Here?
I wish at the beginning of that journey that I had had Virgie's book. I was one of those people who was not able to embrace her size. I have been heavy to obese to extremely obese for the majority of my life. And to me, that was something that I was always compelled to apologize for. It was something I needed to... Sorry, I got a little emotional. So being heavy all my life has been always something that I felt was something I needed to apologize for, something that was wrong with me, that I was taking an outsized amount of space, much more than I was allowed to, much more than I had been allotted. I bought into the fairy tale of weight loss, that idea that anybody can lose weight. It's as simple as not eating anymore and exercising more. And once I was thin, I would live happily ever after, and I would be able to have the job that I wanted and the happiness that I needed. And, you know, diets don't work. I mean, there is so much scientific evidence over and over and over. Diets do not work. Diets make you twice as unhealthy as you were, as you think that you were when you were heavy. And I felt just this increasing pressure to get away from this body that I felt trapped in, that I felt like I could not do anything about. And weight loss surgery to me felt like a miracle. It felt like an escape, that I can run away from this unrelenting feeling of not being good enough and not being the right size for a world that very distinctly is not made for people of size, and frequently genuinely dislikes fat people and expresses that in really a dramatic number of ways. So weight loss surgery felt like a way out of that, a hatch that I could just dive down and leave all of this behind and not have to worry about it and not have to work to be accepted. It felt exhausting to me, and I felt like I wasn't strong enough to do the work that I needed to do to be happy in the face of all the pressure of the world disliking overweight people.
Can you talk a little about just the physical process of getting weight loss surgery? Because that was a story I had not read before, and it was kind of eye-opening and frightening and also just really interesting.
If I had really read carefully, if I hadn't gone, oh my gosh, magic bullet, I'm on it, and leapt into the whole thing, I'm not sure I actually would have done it, because it really is terrifying. The basic procedure is that they take your stomach and they remove a good 3/4 of it. Your stomach is gone. And then they take your intestines, the type I got. There are really a remarkable number of weight loss surgeries. The type I got, which is the most extreme, because I thought I needed to get the most extreme to get the most extreme results. And they actually also reroute your intestines such that you do not absorb calories and fat as efficiently as you previously had. And that results in really dramatic weight loss. They perform it laparoscopically, which, you know, that means lasers and science and the future. So I don't have...
Supposed to be all clean.
Exactly. I don't have big scary scars, but I mean, it's such a dramatic procedure. I was in the hospital for 3 days recovering while they did leak tests, which are what they do to make sure that, you know, your stomach is actually sewn up tightly enough that you can use it as a stomach and not as a leaky balloon. And my intestines weren't going to collapse into ash. And then for about a month afterwards, I was exhausted and miserable and nauseous, and I drank a lot of protein shakes that made me really, really unhappy about life and being alive. And I remember, and the horrible thing is, I remember thinking, wow, this is totally going to be worth it because I'm going to lose so much weight, and then this will be a distant memory and I will be happy. But yeah, you lose the weight so, so quickly, and there's sort of an exhilaration that comes with it that disguises the fact that there are so many physical side effects like gas and bathroom issues. So that the physical trauma is sort of overshadowed after a while by this dream come true, the weight's falling off as if you had cancer or something, you know?
In one passage about midway through the book, when you'd lost about 40 pounds, you wrote, "Getting weight loss surgery was like setting off in a full-out sprint away from all the terribleness inside me that had clearly developed as a result of my weight. But in my flight, I also carried away all the good things, the things that had been untouched by my size. I'm abandoning the person I was, negating all of my previous accomplishments, my entire life." What did you mean by that?
I blamed all my unhappiness on having been fat and all of the difficulties of my life. I was in an unhappy relationship. I hated my job. I was a really crappy friend. I was depressed. I spent a lot of time in bed with a pillow on my head. And I felt like a genuinely awful person who was worthless and had never accomplished anything. And I thought that once I lost all the weight, I would not be that person anymore. I would transform into a brand new shiny person who was happy and could fix her relationship and find a great job and be a good person. And what I was doing when I made that decision, when I decided that losing the weight would fix me, was completely negating all the accomplishments, everything I had ever achieved in my life, not despite being fat and not because I was fat, but because I was the person who I was. I had made the mistake of making weight the entire focus of my life, and I neglected the fact that I had gotten a master's degree, I had written a book, I had been a good person in so many ways. Clearly not a perfect person, but I was a good person, and I could not see that in any way. I did not think any of that was worth anything. I think we have such complicated relationships with our bodies that it can be really a daily struggle to remember that, you know, we're worth something, whatever size we are. I mean, I think there's this pervasive idea that if we fix one thing about ourselves, you know, if my hair were straighter or I were taller or I made more money or I lost 5 pounds or my breasts were one size larger, I would be better and happy. I think Valerie Frankl, I think it was her book, Thin is the New Happy, she talked about making a conscious effort to stop that parade of thoughts. And she was just astonished by how often they would come up when she started paying attention.
You're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael, and I'm speaking with Jen Larson, author of Stranger Here, and Virgie Tovar, editor of Hot and Heavy. I'm curious about the responses that you've both gotten to your books, and I had meant to go online and kind of dig around for comments on blogs and stuff, but I just didn't get a chance. I was busy reading the books. But I mean, just given how core fat hating is to our culture right now, it's hard for me to imagine that you haven't gotten a lot of intense negative response, as well, I'm sure, as a lot of really positive responses from women who are not used to having their body types and their choices validated. So can you both talk a little about that? Virgie, you want to start?
So for the most part, I feel like my experience has been that the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. I can't really recall any specific instances of like super negative feedback, but I'm also somebody who tends to focus on people really liking something rather than people really not liking something. And I think, you know, that psychology, I think, has a lot to do with the way that I have changed a lot in terms of my attitudes towards my body, because I certainly came from a history of fat hating, and I definitely relate to what Jen is talking about. But what the other thing that I think I should say in terms of feedback, so I feel like most of the correspondence I've gotten, you know, all of the correspondence I've gotten has been really positive, has been really, you know, moving. People have really, you know, for the most part, any feedback that might not be super positive is often constructive. Like, I wish there were more stories from trans women. I wish there were stories from this group that didn't get heard or didn't get submitted to the book. And that feedback is really, really useful to me. I have to also say that, you know, when I go out in public and do readings or lectures and whatnot, I'm pretty feisty. And like, so for example, before Q&A of a reading or a lecture, I will usually say in a sort of as a public service announcement that if somebody asks a fatphobic question, that I will make a loud, annoying noise and then publicly shame them. And so that usually curbs people's desire to be fatphobic. Honestly, I don't make myself super available to those, and I try not to make the contributors available to those kinds of negative attacks. And I also cut them off by, for example, I do like video series, blogs, and I just decided to turn off the comments. And I know that I'm losing traffic and I'm losing SEO points, but I'm willing to make that sacrifice so that my videos or my website are a space where people feel like they don't have to see that.
That's very important. Jen, can you talk about the response that you get?
For the most part, I've been incredibly grateful and lucky. I wanted to write the book to reach out to people who felt like they didn't have the answers, who felt incredibly alone in this idea that they needed to figure out what they had to offer outside of their struggle with their body image. And I've gotten so many emails from people saying, you know, I don't have a weight problem, but you made me think about how I feel about myself and how I need to change my life. And that has just been overwhelming and thrilling and exactly what I wanted to do. Then I have people who congratulate me for losing so much weight and tell me how beautiful I look. And I say, wow, you didn't read the book. Okay. And then I have the people, and it's a lot of people in the weight loss surgery community are apparently kind of divided. I've made an effort to not go looking for this stuff, but occasionally I'll hear something. There are people in the weight loss surgery community who say, when I say, you know, losing all that weight didn't solve all my problems, there's so much more to happiness than the size of your jeans. These are people who call me a whiner and can't believe that I don't remember my surgery date and I didn't follow my doctor's instructions, and I'm just this ridiculous, awful, awful example, and I'm giving weight loss surgery a bad name, and that they can't believe somebody let me write a book. And then there are the other weight loss surgery patients who say, yeah, you know what, it's not as easy as it looks. There's this conception that weight loss surgery is the easy way out, that you don't have to diet, you just lose the weight, and it's all wonderful sunshine and springtime. And those are the other people I wanted to reach and talk to about. I want to talk about how important it is to address the issues behind whatever problems you have, if that makes sense. I never sat down and thought about there are so many reasons for whatever size we are. It's genetic. It's not the cliche of the, you know, the horrible fat person just eating themselves to death. I mean, that's such bull. But I did personally have a complicated relationship with food, and that contributed to my size, and I never even thought about addressing that. I was trying to sort of do an end run around my eating disorder, and that's something I wanted to talk about.
One of the things I hear a lot, and I mean, I'm a fat woman, although, you know, I don't know that people necessarily perceive me as obese. I think the medical community definitely does. And I'm extremely healthy in general. And one of the things I was interested in your book, Jen, is that it seems like you were too. And people will always say, well, I'm just worried about your health. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's not that I'm bigoted. I just want everyone to be healthy. And I want people to be able to exercise. And I'm like, well, you know, I exercise all the time. Like, actually. How much truth is there in this idea that we have that fat people are unhealthy and thin people are healthier?
What I've discovered is when you begin to interrogate people who say things like, I just want people to be healthy, or you interrogate the belief system, you quickly discover usually that their concerns don't really reside in concerns for a person's health. And essentially, these kinds of statements are basically a repackaging of fat phobia. And I mean, I think that to sort of engage with that critically, these people don't always consciously know that they're being fat phobic, and they may in fact believe that they are being well intentioned because these kinds of statements are really pervasive in our culture. So essentially, we live in a culture in which stigma or discrimination is highly coded. And by that I mean, like with fat phobia, for example, there's a lot of language that obscures that a view like that is in fact biased or discriminatory. And our culture is extraordinarily skilled at kind of doing this, at targeting marginalized groups and adopting a rhetoric that repackages the aggression into a seemingly innocuous, if not condescendingly simplistic point of view. So what you'll find is that there's this conflation of beauty standards with health in the United States. And the truth is that the prevailing beauty standards have nothing to do with health. And I would even argue that they are specifically interested in ill health. And I always say two things. First, health is holistic, and there's an entire body of theory called stigma theory or minority stress theory that actually was recently used in the Prop 8 trials that detail the way that discrimination leads to shortened lives and decreased quality of life because of the mental stress of dealing with it all the time. So, you know, if you're really interested in someone's health, A, you need to understand that health is something that is multiple dimensions, and mental health is a big part of health. In general, and that discriminating against people or repackaging fat phobia through concern rhetoric is in fact contributing to people's ill health. And second, and this regards the war on obesity, there are a million ways to promote health, primarily among them not declaring war on people or their bodies.
Jen, do you feel like you're healthier since you had your surgery and since you've become thin?
The idea that I wasn't healthy when I was fat was, as Virgie mentions, it was infuriating. And when I was losing the weight, I was not healthy at all. At all. I was smoking and drinking and eating worse than I ever had when I was heavy. And I am now trying to be concerned with eating not processed things. And I run basically for my mental health, because I'm not a very good runner, but there are women who are 2, 3, 4 times my size who run marathons. As Virgie was saying, it is absolutely and utterly impossible to gauge somebody's health by looking at their size. It becomes an aesthetic issue. You know, aesthetically to me, you are not appealing, and so I think that it's not healthy for you to not give me a boner.
Right, yes. When you think about the way that fat phobia works, it's specifically, and especially even with the health rhetoric, it specifically targets women almost all the time. When you look at the history of the way that women's bodies have been constructed in science and culture, women's bodies have been highly pathologized.
You know, I'm about 20 years older, I think, than both of you, and certainly since my childhood, there's been all this pressure on women to be thinner, and, you know, this assumption that fat equals bad was very prevalent when I was growing up, but I feel like it's only gotten worse and worse. And, you know, so when I was a kid, fat people were ugly and we were undesirable and we were to be made fun of, but we weren't actually considered terrorists. You know, where now, I mean, it's really, as you say, the war on obesity, you know, becomes the war on fat people, and we shouldn't, we don't deserve health care. And not only that, but the fact that we occasionally get it, usually when we're really quite sick, you know, is driving up the cost for everybody. And so we need to be ostracized and punished and made to buy 2 plane tickets. And although I have to say that I'm not in the category of people who have to buy 2 plane tickets. And that's, I just find that, but like, I find that such an outrage. And I feel like 20 years ago, people would have been demonstrating about that and making a fuss about it. and embarrassing the people who thought that was okay. And now it's the people who are in that position who are being embarrassed. You know, because I felt like with the women's movement and people starting to talk about these issues and so many great books being written that we were going to make progress on this. And I feel like if anything, you know, we've made a lot of negative progress. Do you share that impression or am I overstating it?
In my opinion, we're at a point of tension in our culture. And when I say that, I mean, we're changing in both directions, meaning there's incredible positive movement and there's incredible negative movement. Social media have created an unprecedented platform for organizing. And I see a level of critical engagement around fatphobia that I think would have been impossible before the internet. On the other hand, at the same time, and I feel like they're fueling each other, the war on obesity has created a new platform for government-sanctioned fat phobia that has and will continue to have negative effects. So, and I see very much like, you know, a lot of the, essentially what I think my, if I were going to forecast it as somebody who has looked at historical, you know, political movements, my forecast would be that the war on obesity is in fact fueling the discrimination. It's fueling the stigma. And when you sort of are fueling something so intensely, you are also perhaps inadvertently fueling a movement that is going to respond to it.
I absolutely agree. Suddenly there are these amazing websites, these amazing writers like Kate Harding and Leslie Kinzel and all these fat positive movements that are so visible online that, and you know, Virgie's book. And I would have been so grateful as a teenager to have these examples and to have these voices speaking for me. And I think that, as Virgie was saying, I think the more we have people shouting about the war on obesity, the more people we're going to have shouting them down. Fat girls are finding pictures of themselves. You know, they're finding images of themselves online. They're finding communities. There's, I don't remember the name of it, there's a Facebook community that is all about fat fashion and sourcing gorgeous outfits and being fashionable and beautiful. And these are amazing, amazing things that I think can only raise a new generation of women who are refusing to listen to this kind of rhetoric and who are going to continue to fight back and continue to demand to be represented and to have a voice and not be marginalized or mocked or tortured for not looking like some societal norm.
Jen Larson is the author of Stranger Here, How Weight Loss Surgery Transformed My Body and Messed with My Head. Virgie Tovar is the editor of Hot and Heavy, Fierce Fat Girls on Life, Love, and Fashion. We'll have links to both of their books and their websites, which offer really great resources for more reading and thinking about these issues. I think this has been a really great conversation. Thanks both of you for taking this time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. Don't forget to join Middle East Children's Alliance this Wednesday for an evening with Angela Davis at First Congregational Church of Berkeley, Channing and Dana. Angela is celebrating the release of her new book, The Meaning of Freedom and Other Difficult Dialogues. Tickets are $15, $10 low income, from www.meccaforpeace.org or by calling 510-548-0542. Or you can get them at a number of bookstores. You can find that information on our website, www.kpfa.org. That's it for this week's edition of Women's Magazine. Next week, we'll have some special feminist programming for Earth Day. Our blog is kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com. You can find archived segments from our past shows there, as well as information about all of today's guests. If there's a story you'd like us to cover or a women or gender-centered event you want us to announce, please email us at kpfawomensmag@gmail.com. And we're always looking for women who want to work with us. I'm Kit Raphael. Thanks for listening.
At this particular moment, we're beyond KPFA's 8th birthday on the air. Broadcasting actually started at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on April 15, 1949.
When I get older, losing my hair, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday? birthday greetings, bottle of wine.
Hey, guess what? KPFA is 64 years old. It's our birthday! 64 years of listener-sponsored community radio. And if you like our presents, how about a present? An online gift would be great. Go to kpfa.org and pledge. Celebrate KPFA and Pacifica. We're 64. Happy birthday, KPFA!
Oh, will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
These are your listener-supported KPFA. These are your listener-supported radio stations, KPFA, KPFB, Berkeley, KFCF, and Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. We have a special news update, and then it'll be time for About Health with Dr. Michael Lenore.
I'm Mark Merkle with a KPFA news update. Three bombs have exploded in Boston. Two people are confirmed dead. Two of the bombs.